The stripe thing almost reads a little sad the way they worded it. It's almost like it's not you, it's me. It's you're just more of an asset, and I need more of a medium of an exchange, and it's just worded.
It's Bad Voltage Season 2, Episode 25, on Thursday, the 25th of January, which is 5 days before my birthday. Hooray.
So, are you fishing?
Shamelessly fishing for for birthday gifts and compliments. Yes, I am.
So I said wishes, not gifts.
On this show, we have me, I'm Stuart Langridge. We have Jeremy. Big up, Jeremy.
Yeah, hi.
I don't know that we need to introduce
each and every person individually, but sure, all right.
I thought it made sense because we don't have Jono. This is the important thing.
Right? This is the important thing.
Gallivanting around somewhere. So we've decided we're going to get a better presenter in instead. So we have the one, the only, Steve Wally. Hello, Steve. Speak up.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Good friend of the show, Steve Wally, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Steve works at Microsoft, and we'll get onto that later. But before we talk about Microsoft, I want to talk about the GPL. So we're going to talk about Fuchsia and Apple and WebKit and the GPL and the decline and licenses and everything.
And he pretty much does mean and everything. And then, as Stuart mentioned, Steve works at Microsoft, so we thought we'd get some honest, frank discussion going about where Microsoft is and their transition towards the new, friendlier Microsoft, what they're doing in open source, what they're doing in Azure. Really quite a good segment, I think, about just where the company has been and is headed. And also, we'll give you a chance to get in there and ask your questions, so we look forward to that. And now, Bad Voltage.
On the last show, Jono mentioned Fuchsia, which is Google's new, potentially new kernel for something. We're not exactly sure what, whether that's mobile devices or Google Homes or whatever. And it made me think about the GPL a bit. And I've got a theory. My theory is that I've heard an awful lot of people inside companies talk about how they're very, very averse to the GPL. Don't want to use GPL projects, don't want to use GPL software, just not prepared to touch it. Copyleft license means no. And the Fuchsia thing and speculation on why Google are doing it made me think about Apple and WebKit. See, Apple wanted a browser. They didn't have one. And when iOS X first came out, it was using Internet Explorer as the browser, right? And they wanted a browser, so they could have taken Gecko, the Mozilla browser engine, and contributed to it or forked it or whatever if they wanted to, and they didn't. They took KHTML, which is one step above just printing, you know, the Lynx browser. They took KHTML and then tricked it up into WebKit, which has now dominated the world, right? Clearly a good decision. But the question remains, why didn't they take Gecko and do that? And I think it's because Gecko is under the MPL, which is a weak copyleft license. Now, some of this is to do with control and how they want control over the project and its direction and so on and so forth. But I think a lot of it is this aversion to copyleft, aversion to GPL. I think you've got Apple doing that with WebKit. You've got people's aversion to GPL generally inside companies and in general in development. Now Google doing Fuchsia. This feels like they might all be the same thing. What do you chaps think?
So just to clarify here, your contention is that it was not the Mozilla build process or the quality of the Gecko rendering engine, which they have since themselves replaced, that led Apple down this road.
It was predominantly
a licensing decision.
I am sure that they looked into those things and they would have played a part in it. But I think a part and potentially a big part of the reason is aversion to copyleft.
And then by deductive reasoning, you think Google is not interested in perhaps writing a sensible, modern, everything is namespaced, everything is sandboxed, everything is an object, kind of like Plan 9, capabilities from the ground up, standard RPC between OS components. You don't think them wanting to build that from scratch is the reason for them doing something new? You think it's because Android is GPL'd?
I think it's because they want to get away from the Linux kernel's GPL nature. Yes.
Okay.
So
that's what I think. Because look how successful Plan 9 has been. Every day I see people with Plan 9 laptops wandering around the town.
One specific interesting thing about it.
Right. But I think you have a valid point there. I think everybody has
Plan 9. Shut up. Sorry.
Exactly. Well, that's the point I thought we were talking about was the Plan 9 point. No, I think it's an interesting problem because there was a keynote I saw a couple of years ago where Martin Fink, who was the CTO for all of Hewlett Packard at the time, basically asked the question, have we defaulted the wrong way as a set of businesses? We always default to permissive. We always say that Apache is the business-friendly license. And he's thinking that maybe that isn't true, that maybe we should be defaulting to reciprocal licensing. And at the time, I thought about that, and I thought it was really interesting. And there was a study done a couple of years before that, actually probably 7 years ago now, by Henrik Ingo. And he did a big number crunch across all the open source projects of 7 years ago. And what he discovered was that the 9 largest, most active communities were all hubbed in foundations. And after Martin gave his keynote, I went back and I thought, I wonder what their licenses are. And 8 of the 9 are reciprocal licensed. 6 are GPL'd, 1's the Mozilla group, 1's the Eclipse group, and it's only the Apache group hubbed in a foundation that actually has the Apache license on it. That's the only permissive license that was on any of the big 9 projects at the time. And the 10th, just to put it in perspective, the 10th largest project 7 years ago was an order of magnitude smaller. Now, at the time, he was being a good engineer. He said, here's all my data, here's my assumptions, and I'm not claiming causality that you should put your stuff in a foundation. So I'm not going to claim, gosh, you should put it under a reciprocal license. But I think reciprocal licenses drive a particular behavior early on in a project. And as that project grows to a point that a foundation might form around it, I think that companies approach those projects differently. If you've gone through the effort of creating the foundation because you want to clean up the IP situation because you're a company, you get really careful about what you put in the bucket when it's reciprocal licensed, but you contribute to the core. And what we've seen since then, the big projects since then are what? Node is one of them. I don't actually know how
Node, the whole NPM ecosystem. Yep.
I actually don't know what the license on the Node ecosystem is.
Basically nothing in NPM is GPL'd.
I would not be surprised. The OpenStack world went with we're going to do an Apache default. Kubernetes and the CNCF seem to be going in that direction. So lots of new projects are happening in that way. But I think OpenStack, it's a warning sign along the road. OpenStack grew immense very quickly. There were suddenly 29 or 30 projects over the first few years, and everybody had their favorite project that they were bringing in. And well, it was this business-friendly environment that was Apache licensed. And I think that business-friendly here means, if it's a success, I can always lock my product code away because Apache license allows that. And if it's a failure, I can always pull my IP back. You saw this massive amount of VC investment in small companies jumping into the OpenStack world. And we're seeing the same thing happening in the Kubernetes world right now. And so I'm not sure, I don't know that business-friendly is necessarily good for the community of folks that are genuinely trying to work on and communicate and collaborate.
I think the Apache license kind of gets its quote-unquote business-friendly label, not from being any more business-friendly, but as you try to get licenses into a company that maybe wasn't a traditional open source company, lawyers look at that as a license that was clearly written by lawyers for lawyers. And I think that as part of that is, if you contribute to an Apache 2 license thing, it's very explicit in the license that your contributions are Apache 2, where it's implicit in GPL and most of the permissive licenses. And while we get licensing, I think maybe a little bit more than most, that's a little unsettling, I think, for lawyers. So that's where I think the Apache 2 license being more business friendly goes. I don't know that there's a big precedent for a corporation releasing something large, building it up, and then closing it. I don't think the precedent's really there. So I'm not overly concerned about it. I think if you had a lot of velocity there, the community would be able to soldier on. I think the study that you reference is a pretty old data point that even then massively favored fairly old established projects. So while it's something maybe to learn historically there, I don't know what it says about the current landscape.
Are you saying history doesn't matter? Are you saying history doesn't matter, or are you saying that I'm just gray-haired
and
old?
No, history matters immensely. There's always something to be learned from history.
Well, yeah, but I think if you look at that, the projects that you talk about there, which were copyleft, reciprocal licensing, they're all basically grandfathered in, right? Name a GPL project or any other reciprocal license of your choice, a GPL project which is a big deal and is attracting contributors now and isn't 20 years old.
And that,
not
that,
any.
Yeah, no, and I think that really is the last 7 years. That it's just a discussion that doesn't come up because I think people were so freaked out by the rhetoric around software freedom in the 90s that's carried through. I mean, certainly Microsoft made hay with that. Oracle made hay with that. There was this feeling and misunderstanding at the time that somehow the attach would strip away your IP rights. And you know, we've seen lots of companies demonstrate that that's not actually true. You know, there's that.
Do you think some of the fervor around GPL3 and the landscape at that time, a time at which Linus clearly said Linux is not going to GPLv3, we are not taking the and later clause of the GPL, we are pinning it to version 2. Do you think that kind of sent a little bit of a shockwave through and for other people, maybe especially people just getting into open source saying, well, if the person in charge of the largest GPL project doesn't like the direction that this organization is going, maybe there's a better way. Maybe there's a different path forward for things that I'm going to license myself. Do you think that had anything to do with it, or do you think it's more of a permissive versus not permissive thing?
I think that possibly had a lot to do with it. Because, I mean, the three of us have argued over many a dinner table that I think licenses are important because it's the law. And you guys laugh at me because it's not the law, but you just say nobody cares. It's like, I understand that nobody wants to learn about licensing.
Aussie,
you don't get to avoid it.
I think people care. I think Jono falls on one side of this, and he's not here to defend himself, but I think he'll agree with this in that he doesn't care.
Well, so the interesting thing, though, is if GitHub's numbers, what is it? There's 50 million or 60 million repositories of apparently only 20 million of them have a license on it.
Yeah.
So there's.
I think GitHub did a very large disservice in the beginning by almost encouraging no license,
correct,
which they've since corrected. But that really changed the licensing landscape.
GitHub are roughly at about 20% of licenses of repositories are licensed.
I actually thought it was higher.
It may have gone up a bit, but it's still on that kind of 20-30% order. You know, the line is creeping up. It crept down for quite a bit, down to sort of 2015. And it has trended up a bit after GitHub got a bit of kicking about this.
Right.
But we're still, most of them don't have licenses in them. Of those that do, 50% there or thereabouts are MIT.
Right. And I think that was the default that they chose as their, they didn't choose the default for people creating repositories, but that was the one they encouraged as the simplest license you could put on something.
I think
MIT is essentially, to me, it feels like the I don't care about licensing license, right? Because it's zero hassle.
Right, it is certainly the most permissive of all of the popular licenses.
Well, and the joy of it is, I mean, again, you look at this in the context of history. We have shared software since we started writing it in 1950. The only reason any of us have this debate, discussion, whatever you want to call this, is that in 1980, after 30 years of collaborating on software and sharing it around at conferences, on tapes, in rudimentary, you know, acoustic coupler networks, in 1980, United States put computer software under copyright law. So suddenly, all of those people collaborating couldn't trivially collaborate anymore. And so one of the earliest experiments was actually MIT Athena. And the university lawyers came up with the simplest language they knew how. And the joy of that language is it was pretty robust in terms of standing the test of time. If you look at this as a set of experiments over the next 20 years from kind of 1980 to 2000, it's a set of licensing experiments where companies and people collaborating had to wrestle with this. How do we do this under copyright law on software? And so, you end up with the experiments from Berkeley. You end up with the experiments from MIT. You end up with free software is another licensing experiment. Take all the rhetoric out of it. It's just a licensing experiment. And so finally we get to Mozilla, and Mozilla won. It's like, that was the first time corporate lawyers ever tried to write a license. And it was a little awkward. Apache 2 cleaned that up, because Apache 1 was the BSD license. Apache 2 is basically more corporate lawyers got involved. And you finally get to the IBM public license and the Common public license, which were very clearly, written for the Eclipse Foundation from a different perspective. So we've seen lots of evolution in licensing, but they're all experimental. And they're all there to address the problem that in 1980, the U.S. Copyright Office said, we can't share that way anymore.
See, but that's not just fighting the last war. That's fighting the war before that, right? Because you say, there was that 20 years from 1982 to 2000. Agreed. But that was 20 years ago.
Yep.
There've been another 20 years since then. And since then, if we are, in general, in favour of the idea of copyleft for the reasons you kind of outlined, that maybe we made the wrong choice about the business-friendly license being permissive, so on and so forth. Copyleft advocates have done a spectacularly poor job of persuading anybody that it's the case. And the reason I picked up Apple on the WebKit thing or Google on Fuchsia or whatever is because those companies could have decided at that point, okay, if we're going to build a new thing anyway, why don't we GPL it? And they did not. And they will continue, I think, to not do so, because I think the thing they don't like is the GPL.
I think what they don't like isn't the reciprocity. That's not the thing. I think it's the rhetoric that was wrapped around that reciprocity.
So you don't think it's a GPL in and of itself of the concept? Do you think it's the GPL and FSF's mentality?
I'll be a little crisp here. I think GPL v2 is a great license in terms of being a reciprocal license. I think GPL v3, despite the fact that all of the industry lawyers collaborated on that license, and I thought that was a really impressive negotiation over that period of time. At the end of the day, because it was still ultimately owned by the Free Software Foundation, they made a land grab on software distribution definitions and on DRM that basically salted the fields around GPL v3. And for businesses. So we have to go back to, okay, GPL v2, and you end up in that space of, well, it is actually kind of an old license now. And I think it's 1991 was when GPL v2 was written. And, it's when, and then again, you contrast it, like you guys said, you contrast that with a license that's been clearly written by corporate lawyers to a corporate purpose in, Mozilla 2, Eclipse, Apache 2. These are licenses that a corporate lawyer can pick up and go, oh, yeah, I recognize the layout, the framework, the terminology. It all means something to me. I'm not too scared when I first open it up. Whereas, you open up GPL v2 and you start with a manifesto.
But you also don't see people licensing new projects under GPL v2 pinned like Linux.
Correct. And I think...
Or do you think it's just because of the name GPL is poison? Do you think we need a new strongly protective license that isn't GPL?
Well, and I think that would be a great idea on one hand, but at the same time, I got to fall back on the discussions of 15 years ago where we've already got, 70 different licenses that the OSI
has. I was going to say, the odds of this can't possibly
we really don't need another license.
I tend to not want new licenses, but I just was curious on the answer.
We need the bad voltage permissive license that is written by corporate lawyers that is very crisp.
BVPL.
I know it's the old war, Stuart, but at the same time, it's also the old war is, I understand why somebody probably thought copyright law was a thing to protect the intellectual property in a piece of software, but when you look at it, it's idiocy. That decision was made at a time where network bandwidth was defined by, you know, tape-sized packets and conference latency. So the idea of the speed that software changes. Oh, we fixed a bug. Okay, well, that's a derivative. Oh, we've added a feature. Oh, that's a derivative. You know, the speed of change when you open up the World Wide Web to collaboration is horrific. In 1991, I worked for a small software company in Canada. And at that time, to file your copyright protection in the United States, you had to send in the copyright form and the first 17 pages of printout of the program. I don't know why it was 17. I don't know why it wasn't 16 or maybe 18, but 17 was the number. And it's like
someone's favorite number, I presume.
Who created this? Well, it was probably the form was 3 pages long, so it was a nice 20-page block that they could bind easily or some idiocy like that. I have no idea. But, you know, it's that's the way software was happening, kind of right on the cusp of the internet exploding. And that's why you look at it, like software, until we had James Cameron and, you know, George Lucas, movies were fairly stable. You know, the movie came out, the copyright on it was the copyright on it, and it didn't change a lot. You didn't end up with 5 different director's cuts in the next week. And it's like, you look at music, music's a very messy space, but it's, you know, it's a somewhat stable thing. Books, you don't, textbooks, you get a little different. You can start to add chapters to it as technology, you know, evolves. But, you know, the average novel, aside from a few small, you know, mistakes for typos, it's not like the next printing changed a lot. So copyright makes sense in a lot of those cases. But you look at the dynamic nature of software, and, you know, copyright was a stupid idea. There's a particularly good lawyer right now that works, does a lot of external work for Red Hat, named Pamela Chestick. And she basically argues that trademark is probably the best way to protect your software project. And
yeah, but we can't. Fine. Maybe I agree with you, but we can't get there from here. We can't just blow up the world and reconstitute it a different way.
No, but it's. I think having the conversation. It's not that we can tear away copyright, or that we should change the software freedom definition or the open source definition. But I think understanding the historical context of some of these discussions and decisions allows us to at least think about, so what are the real problems we're trying to solve as we all sit down and collaborate on the next project? You know, what's the thing we have to do?
Let's crawl before we walk and fix software patents before we go down that road, be my opinion. But
here, here.
In the current Congress?
Just as a... So it sounds like, to kind of get this train back to the station...
Apparently they can't even pass a budget in the country I'm living in right now. So, you know, the idea that we're going to go fix patent law at the same time,
We're not going to talk about politics. It's all terrible.
Okay.
Stay with software.
And Stuart is bright-eyed once again in this show. It sounds like ACK pretty much thinks that protective licenses are coming to an end for new projects moving forward. Is that a fair assessment? Steve, do you think there's going to be a renaissance here, or do you think...
It's interesting to hear what Steve's talking about is the sorts of arguments you'd made if someone comes up with a compelling thing, and maybe the answer to that is the bad voltage public license or whatever, you know. Someone comes up with a new thing. If the problem with the GPL is not the GPL itself, but GPL advocates, then obviously the people who are going to fix this problem are not GPL advocates.
Yeah, they think they fixed it. It's called GPL V3.
And they continue to advocate that line.
And they're welcome, so
they have massively observationally failed. Not only are people observationally not using the license, but I mean admittedly anecdata, but you can't find anyone who thinks it's a good idea for new projects that they want to work on. If they're involved in building a product or building something inside a company or building something that wants wide adoption, everyone who's adopting it is adopting it ideologically first, which is the FSF's goal, right? They want you to be ideological first and then decide what software you wanted to write afterwards. But
I think they've not only lost market share, to your point, they've lost mind share.
Lost mind share, absolutely.
So, as we said in the intro, we have Stephen Wally here in place of Senior John O'Bacon. And what I thought it'd be interesting to talk about Microsoft a little bit, since he is the principal program manager in Azure Engineering. So I know Microsoft is obviously
a program manager. That's a very singular title. There's many of people like me.
One of the principal program.
How are you principal then? Sorry, I mean carry on.
So I thought we could just discuss some Azure-related things and Microsoft-related things. It's you have some, I think, organizationally, some pretty interesting hires lately. You know, Ashley McNamara, I thought was a good one. Campbell from Drupal, I thought was a good one, who both articulated very well why they joined the company. You had Jess Frizzell join the company and say that Microsoft was doing the most interesting stuff with Linux, which is a pretty bold statement. You know, there's quite a bit changing. You host the largest Git repository in the world, which is the Windows source code. And not only that, but you've recently contributed as an organization quite a bit back to Git as far as performance tweaks that you needed to make that happen. You know, the rumor is, I don't know if you guys have confirmed this, like half of Azure actually is running Linux. Because of your Microsoft's recent virtualization work, you're the fifth largest contributor to the 3.x Linux kernel. You know, if you look at GitHub, one of the biggest projects by contributor count is actually a Microsoft project. And in fact, Ak and I are working on a project, and we used a Microsoft component as part of that in GHCrawler. And not only that, found some bugs in it, sent them upstream, and they were fixed pretty rapidly and merged pretty quickly. So it seems like while Microsoft is a very large ship and is not easy to turn, and there's always going to be someone, probably in sales, that's going to be, you know, the equivalent of Hiro Odona and not know the war is over. But do you think that the ship is finally turning? Do you think that's real? And if so, how's that transition going? Or do you think this is all very elaborate lip service?
Well, it's definitely not lip service. I think if you look at the history of the company, and the company's almost 40 years old now, or it might be just over 40 years old, the company has always been about developers, and at this point in history, it's always had a developer.
You don't think there's a large Steve Ballmer potentially era where you are very much no longer about developers?
He stood on stage and went, developers. He was a pillock about it.
Yeah, he might have been a business person, but that's the interesting thing, right? The original CEO was a developer. We had the Ballmer years, but even he recognized it, you know, developers, developers, developers. And then the new CEO is a developer. That's where these people have come from. The history of Microsoft as a tools and operating platform has always been about developers. And at this point in history, and certainly, you know, for those of us like yourselves that have been around this community for a long period of time, sharing and collaborating is the way a lot of good software happens. And at this point, Microsoft deeply understands that if you're going to focus on developers, developers care about open source. And so Microsoft has had to come through that learning curve. My brief history. So I was here 99 to 2004 at sort of the height of the fear. You know, the Halloween document was what, 1997 or 98?
Yeah.
We were in the midst of the
GPL is a cancer.
There was the Pac-Man statement, the cancer statement, the un-American statement. You know, pick your executive and you can find a statement. But that was also almost 20 years ago. You know, we're now a 40-year-old company. And, you know, we've gone through a dramatic different growth. We're to a certain extent, we've been humbled by the Department of Justice in this country. We've been humbled by the EU. We continue to behave in a more cautious fashion in the marketplace. But put that aside for a minute. At the end of the day, we're a developer-centric company. And so the grand experiments started a number of years ago. So, you know, you've got things like TypeScript. That was Anders' third or fourth language that he was designing and developing. And if you listen to any of him discussing the community he built and continues to run and continues to accept changes, he is nothing but an open source advocate for the company right now and continues to build this massive, thriving community of folks around TypeScript. You look at VS Code and the growth of VS Code and the contribution flow from outside the company. 10 years ago, I used to give Sam Ramji a hard time. I'd say, you know, just because you gave some money to the Apache Software Foundation does not make you an open source company. Where's your contributions? And there weren't any 10 years ago. But like you pointed out, you look at our contribution flow into the Linux kernel at this point, participating in a community that is clearly not our community, and earning the respect of that community by that community's rules. You look at the communities we're growing. You know, back to the discussions we were having about, you know, GPL versus Apache as a licensing mechanism. You know, we're doing Apache license work, we're doing MIT licensed work. There's VS Code, there's .NET Core is another massive project. We open source the PowerShell, and all of these projects are building their own thriving communities. And these are communities that actually are kind of on that scale of a Kubernetes. Like, these are not small communities. And so I'm not saying that suddenly Microsoft gets it, or Microsoft is somehow a transformed corporation. But I think we've got lots of internal proof points that demonstrate this is a very valuable way to build community, a very valuable way to serve your developer community, and a very valuable way to build software.
Stuart has been suspiciously quiet.
I have a number of objections. Well, I have a number of questions, perhaps.
Opinions?
We should say,
I believe opinions this. Was the word you were looking for there.
Yes. So, leave the Linux kernel to one side for the moment. Right, I'll come back to that. Every other project you named is a project which has grown its own community, but it's a project you invented. I'm not convinced Microsoft has bought the open source idea that you can contribute to a thing when it isn't yours. The point is not we're going to open source thing and then all of you other people will come and work on our project and make it better. Why does VS Code exist instead of contributing to Atom, right? You list all the things. Why does TypeScript exist instead of working on JS or even CoffeeScript, although I hate both of them?
Right. Because a guy that understood the JavaScript world and typing and type systems, perhaps, like you said, you hate CoffeeScript, went out and built a better system for it and published it and attracted a community.
But I think that's there's a number of stages.
Why did Linus build Linux if he could have used FreeBSD?
Yeah, could have used Minix or whatever. Absolutely, and there is some value in creating
actually,
new things.
Well, actually, he couldn't use Minix because those folks at Prentice Hall said
sorry,
he couldn't.
Yes, you're right. Yes, hence building the new thing. Yes, but I think there's a few stages to go through, and I'm happy to grant that the Microsoft of today has learned the idea that being open, inviting other people to contribute to projects, to have a thing which is not solely and wholly yours, is a good thing. It does motivate people and it does produce better software at the end of the day, and that's great. But it's still, I think that's brilliant. So I have one question, which is, I don't know how long that would stick around.
We are active contributors in the Hadoop community.
If Nadella left tomorrow and you got 2002 era Steve Ballmer back, do you think the internal Microsoft culture has changed enough that it would reject his ideas, or would you just instantly turn back into 2002 era Microsoft?
Let me frame that a slightly different way, because I had a similar question and you can answer them both at the same time.
Oh, okay.
A cynic may say that the old Microsoft sold proprietary software licenses like Office and like Windows. And with that as a business model, it behooved them to not be friendly to open source. And as they transition to more of a platform and services company, it behooves them to embrace open source because that will net them more revenue. If the next platform, if the next business model shift once again is not open source, does not enable them to make more money, will they simply shift again?
Windows Phone as a speculative example here, right? Imagine that had taken off.
Okay.
The primary thing in the phone world is kind of being closed. It's all controlled by one company. They get to decide, and that's it.
Like the Symbian Foundation.
But Apple doing well in it. Google control the direction of Android.
We're now stacking up quite a few questions from Dan.
This is an enlargement of the previous question. I would very much like to believe that the new "we embrace openness, we want people to be involved" Microsoft would have said, "We're going to lead the charge for," and open phone stack where everyone can contribute. But I don't believe it for a moment, because there's no open Xbox where you are currently winning. So that's the enlargement
Enlargement. So it's a very large question. So it gives me lots of surface to answer the question I would rather answer. You realize that's what you gave me there.
Also, did you say that just in order to shill your line of laptops, Steve Wally? No, go ahead and answer the question any way you see fit.
So I think going back to that statement of developers today, it's not, don't look at it from the marketplace point of view, and I'll tell you why in just a minute. Look at it from the perspective of if we have to follow developers because that's the kind of software we build as platforms and tools for developers, then we're going to have to go where they go. So as long as developers think that open source is important, I think you'll find Microsoft continue to evolve in that direction. If we found out tomorrow that suddenly, you know, if Steve Ballmer came back, I think he would have to accept that there's now the growth in the company and the way the company's doing things and all of these demonstration points says that this is the way to kind of attract developer business, and that's what we're here for. So we have to continue to follow our developers to go where they need to go. Right. So I don't think changing the executive would change the direction of the company with respect to open source, because I think all of our customers and all of the developers on the planet are telling us that, nope, open source is important. We got to go do that. So I don't think that's going to change.
But you're not buying into open source because you actually think it makes better products, just because that's what everyone wants, so you're happy to provide it. But if everyone stopped wanting it, you wouldn't try and persuade them open source makes it better. You just go, fine, you don't want it. We're not going to give it to you. There's so no ideological wedding to the concept at all.
I think we're still in that learning process. So the three of us believe that you get better software, and that software as a component in a project into a product gives you a better set of components that you're going to go build products from, right? That's what the three of us believe.
Yeah.
And I think the company is learning enough in these new experiments over the last number of years that would continue to be a growing thing that the company continues to learn. Hey, we're building fantastic components. And Anders around TypeScript is ecstatic with the number of things that have come in to the TypeScript world from other language researchers and from early adopters and heavy language users. So this idea that you really are building the right tools, I think, is being anchored firmly in the company's psyche. So again, I don't think changing an executive would suddenly change the course.
Okay. I mean, I
do. I do want to go back though to an edge here, where it kind of speaks to some of what
again
Jeremy
with the product.
Well, yeah.
Do you have a list of bingo product names written down that you're scratching?
I got to come back to the thing that you.
You could say you're X-ing the boxes.
The three of us have argued many times, and the fundamental mistake that I see companies making over and over and over again is confusing product and project. And this is something where I think the worst failures we've seen are people get confused. The Helion failure at Hewlett Packard was because all of the engineering dollars for a product called Helion were being spent upstream in OpenStack. So there was no engineering dollars left to turn OpenStack into Helion. So the product suffered horribly, because the parts that were coming out of the system weren't exactly high quality yet. And there wasn't enough, you know, back-end packaging engineering and QA and testing and all the other good things that go into a product. I think at the flip side, when you look at the difference between the Linux kernel and one of the Ask Me Anythings that Jim Whitehurst recently did with Red Hat, he discussed this is how they build the next release of RHEL. And what he said is basically, they take a cut-through Fedora, the current stable version of Fedora, and then they replace the kernel with a more current kernel out of kernel.org, and then they layer on something like 2,100 to 2,600 patches. Okay, that's a piece of software engineering magic right there. That is an enormous barrier to entry for all of the rest of the people that go, I have a distro. I'd like to make it a, I'm going to go start a distro company. No, that's a piece of product engineering that Red Hat has evolved and become enormously good at doing, so that they can leverage their 10% investment in the LinuxKernel.org world and the investment they put into the Fedora world, and then turn around and take those pieces and then and assemble this incredibly robust Linux operating system product for their customers. And then, you know, people go, oh, well, they're charging support. It doesn't matter whether you call it a license, a EULA, or an enterprise agreement, or a support subscription, or any other kind of subscription. It's a dollar amount that a customer gives to Red Hat for peace of mind, for insurance, for a level of quality, for a phone number to call, for a set of things that go with that product. And that's where, you know, so I think Microsoft's still in that learning of going, wow, we can actually participate in these things. You know, I didn't know until you told me that apparently we're number 5 on the list in the latest kernel build. But you know, that speaks to a certain investment in the kernel for our own needs.
So that, because I mean, you said a lot there, and I have so many comments on so many things that I don't want to get
sidetracked. Good comments, though, right?
Well, no, about your assessment of Red Hat and other things. But so do you foresee a time in the near future where a core, and not to the size of Office, but a realistic product from Microsoft is based on a open source project that they then productize? Like, do you see that in the next, in the near term? So let's say 2018 going into 2019 timeframe.
So
as a realistic thing that could happen.
Yes. So I'd have to ask why you don't think our productization in the Visual Studio world or...
Because VS Code is not Visual Studio, and Visual Studio is not based on an open source project.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. VS Code is Atom, basically. It's not Visual... And as far as I'm aware, unless Visual Studio becomes a bunch of VS Code plugins, which would be good, but as far as I can tell, naming them the same is like naming Outlook Express the same as Outlook, because it convinced people they were like similar projects and so you should get involved. Right? They weren't the same.
I mean, maybe I'm just not aware of it, because if we're being completely honest, the last version of Windows that I used on a desktop was called Chicago, and I just am not...
Wow.
Yeah, I did use Chicago, though.
That was
then
a
I switched
long
to
time
Yggdrasil.
Ago.
That was... It was a disconcertingly long time ago. And I mean, aside from the Azure suite of products, which I am a little bit more familiar with than the rest of the Microsoft ecosystem, is there a predominant large for sale Microsoft product that is directly based on an open source project?
I do not know what the current revenues are, so I can't say yes to the question. I know that we continue to evolve in that direction. I know that we continue to build into the Linux world. So I can't give you an easy answer right now, and I'm sorry for that. But sure. I think it's part of the learning curve. I think we are trending in that direction. I think you will find products from Microsoft. But I also think you're going to see Microsoft be as thoughtful, and rightly so, as a Red Hat is in saying, here is the branded product. Here are the open source communities that we pulled it out of, whether it's our communities or somebody else's. And these are the things that got assembled together into this product. And that product is something we sell to a customer.
If you want.
And this is the problem, though, because that exact statement, as I said it there, you know, I can hear Stuart's unhappy with that answer.
No. That wasn't what I was going to say, actually. I'm prepared to buy that. I mean, there are certainly a whole bunch of people who basically do not trust Microsoft and will not trust Microsoft with anything to do with open source because of things that happened in 2003, right?
Yeah, I feel the same way about Oracle. So, yeah. we all have our company.
Everyone feels the same way about Oracle.
I was going to say that. We're all on the same page on that one. I still regularly-ish hear... Embrace, extend, and extinguish. So yeah. People are not ready to forgive quite yet.
No, exactly.
I have more questions.
Totally understand.
People are not upset about stuff that Oracle did to screw up the open source community in 2003. They're upset about stuff that Oracle did to screw up the open source community last Wednesday, right?
So, well, and that's been the interesting thing. You know, after they bought Sun and killed a whole lot of interesting things, they continue to demonstrate that they haven't gone down that learning curve.
Hudson. Oh, no, Jenkins. Right. That's fine. But yeah, MySQL, blah, blah, yeah, but whatever. But yeah, so ignore people who still hate Microsoft because of the Halloween documents or whatever.
Right.
I think the concern I hear from people who have some investment in some kind of open source ecosystem, whether that's, you know, the web or Linux desktops or whatever, is not that Microsoft are not a friend now. You know, people have gone beyond the Microsoft are the enemy. But I think people's concern is that Microsoft are a fair weather friend. That open source is a tool you use when you're currently second or third in the market because it gives you a bit of a leg up. But if you're winning, forget all about all that open source stuff. I can't think of a Microsoft project which is actually the leader in its marketplace and is anything like open source. All the open source stuff is, oh, we need to compete because we're losing, so we'll go open. So it looks a little bit like it's being used as a PR thing.
I think here's the problem, though. If you put Microsoft in that situation, and I literally cannot believe I'm defending Microsoft here.
I'm kind of liking that tonight.
If you look at their three products, they're really only winning in three places, right? Windows, Office, and Xbox. I've never seen the source to any of them, but I'm willing to go out and bet none of the three are open sourceable for a variety of historical licensing third-party component reasons.
Correct.
So if they can't open source any of those three, they can never open source something they're going to win. So I don't see a way for them to change mentality.
Well, so none of us can predict.
But I'm curious to hear your answer to that.
Well, and I think that that's the perfect answer of why we can't go back on the three things we did so successfully, because at the end of the day, there are enormous...
Xbox was not a success. It was you willing to lose billions of dollars to compete with a better product. I don't know that that one's even arguable.
Okay. Let's talk about the other two franchises.
most companies just realistically are not in a situation to burn billions of dollars to build market share.
I disagree. You go pick any of the Fortune 100. Their pockets are deep enough, they make billion-dollar mistakes all the time. And it doesn't destroy the corporation. They sweep it up and redo stocky things. And so the fact that you can't say that about Microsoft like some special situation here. HP.
That's fair. Okay.
HP spent billions of dollars on a big data acquisition, and that didn't work out so well.
So, I mean, bear with me. So I will buy absolutely that you can't just turn around and open source Windows, a 40-year-old code base, or Word, or Excel, or something. Fine, no problem. But as far as I can tell, things like whatever the Windows 10 interface is called, Metro, right? That was new.
Yep.
That's a new thing that got built. It's a radical change to the way the desktop works.
Yep.
None of that was open. And it could have been. That doesn't buy the we built half this code in 1982 and we licensed it off someone thing, right?
And look at structurally a corporation in transition that was done in the Windows organization as part of Windows, and that organization has been tooled up for the entire history of the corporation to do things in a very closed, proprietary kind of way. So the fact that we've taken a new place, Azure, as a new place to do the experiments and are learning from it, says that that's a good thing. I understand your question. I think that's a perfectly valid way to phrase it, Stuart, is, you know, why didn't they do that as an experiment? Well, that's talking about a very deep engineering culture that acts in a particular way and does a particular job. It would have been a great thing for them to have tried.
Yeah, so pick a similar thing, right? Why isn't the hardware in the Surface Pro well documented? I mean, I'm not suggesting that Microsoft should port Linux to it, but the fact that it has to be reverse engineered, and there's no way you can send them a question, they go, this is the thing we use, this is the information you need to build a kernel driver. Again, that's brand new. Microsoft didn't even make hardware apart from mouse wheels until about 4 years ago.
Absolutely.
Would you send that same request to Samsung or Google and expect to get a response on hardware, or Asus or HTC?
Yeah, because you've got people like, if you look at Dell, for example, people like Mario Limoncello actually cooperate. They hang out on the Linux kernel mailing list and they answer questions about the hardware and say, this is why I was reading an email like 2 days ago from Mario Limoncello at Dell saying, yeah, this is why the DSDT tables in our EFI booting thing are built this way, because we're working around this bug. Right?
Right.
If someone asks the question, okay, we can't get the we can't get the Linux driver for the video card to spin up on the brand new Surface Pro laptop, which is gorgeous, and I'd really like a new Surface Book, right? But I'm not going to run Windows on it. I'm going to run Linux on it, and I can't.
Then why do you want the new Surface Book if it's all part? I'm asking this from the perspective of, if I go out and I get the brand new coolest razor thin MacBook, I expect it to come up with you know, Mac OS X. I don't go out and get that latest piece of hardware kit thinking, and I'm going to rebuild a Linux kernel for it. I want the entire experience as it comes out as a device.
If I'm
looking at Microsoft as this very large technology company with lots of different divisions, I think you're going to see the device division behave a lot more like a phone company, while the Azure division is sitting here participating in the Open Compute Project.
But this is exactly my point about how I'm not sure that the "we should be open because it's better" argument is actually permeating. I absolutely think it has in Azure, and it has in like the language development teams and the developer focused projects and so on and so forth. But exactly as you said there, the people making laptops are going to treat them like devices, like appliances. We're not going to talk about them being open hardware or anything like that. But from my point of view, they are PCs. Right? And you can't even get an answer to someone. I'm not suggesting that Microsoft ought to be contributing fixes to the Linux kernel so that it boots. But if the people on Reddit who are reverse engineering this stuff just can have someone to say, how does this work? Why not tell you? Right? Apple don't do that, but then Apple don't claim to be a kind of new open company who are going through that journey. They're like, no, fuck you guys, right? We're not open.
Well, no, we're on the journey. So
yeah, you know, I'm hoping Microsoft could be better at that.
Well, and I would argue that over the last 5 to 10 years, we're getting better at it. So if we had this discussion again in 10 years, it's actually going to be a dramatically different company, and who knows which of the, you know, the big clouds are going to be in what order or any of the rest of it. Yeah. But I think as long as we continue to grow that sense of open hardware, open software base, as long as we continue to collaborate, we're going to get better at it. And I think your counterexample is an interesting one. You know, when you look at Apple, they kind of open sourced Swift because nobody touches a language at this point in history if it's not an open source.
Who is going to use proprietary language? Yeah.
Yeah, but, like nobody does that.
But as you're saying, going through that journey, Apple are very closed about absolutely everything unless they have to not be. But new stuff, like imagine we're sitting here 10 years from now and we're saying, well, now everything just takes place in virtual reality. Is HoloLens going to be open then? To me, it feels like if HoloLens takes off as being the thing that everyone uses, I can't see anyone at Microsoft going, well, I think we should open this now it's been created and it's won. Right. It feels like it'd be like, it's closed, it's going to stay closed.
So, I mean, you're kind of making the same point with different products at this point. I guess a broader question is, given that Microsoft is a very large ship and it is, as you mentioned multiple times, in a transition, where on that transition curve do you think you are currently, and what do you think are the next couple of roadblocks that will get in your way?
That's a good point.
I'm curious to know where you think you stand.
Wow, that's an interesting question. Mm. Damn. I'm not even sure how to soft shoe on that one. because it is. Sitting squarely in the Azure engineering team the way I do, I get to see all of the experimentation that continues to happen in Azure. And the nature of the debates about, you know, why isn't the default to be open on some of these things? And so I'm continuing to watch the decisions trend in all the right directions in my head, you know, being very sensitive to serve the customer, and on the technology build side, how do we collaborate? And that's kind of fascinating. So I think we're continuing. This is no longer the Microsoft of 10 years ago where, you know, look, we have two licenses approved by the OSI and we've given $10,000 to the Apache Software Foundation. You know, we're now the number 5 contributor to Linux and we've got all of these projects that are happening and we're learning how to do these things. And we have people like Jess Frizzell working for us. So, you know, it's, you know, we are attracting, even on the SRE side, you know, we're 2 years ago, I was talking to one of our seniors in there a couple of months ago, and he said 2 years ago, people just laughed at him when he suggested they come to work in SRE on Azure. Whereas now, you know, it's a very rich hiring pipeline because, and these are the people that came out of that whole kind of Unix, Usenix experience of the 80s and 90s and into the noughties of, you know, people that collaborate all the time. This is how you do things, how you talk about how you solve problems in large-scale situations. So I came back because I was excited to continue to contribute. And the Azure world in which I work is dramatically different from the Windows world I left 13 years ago. Even just watching the way the engineering management behaves with one another in review cycles around product development is highly collaborative within the firewall, whereas it used to be a knife fight, you know, 13, 15 years ago. Yeah, because everybody was defending their resource turf. And so, of course, it has to be my way, and of course I need 10 more heads. Whereas now, there's actually this very facilitated, collaborative discussion amongst engineering peers that are making the big, hard decisions about what gets shipped next to solve what problems for customers. So I just see this entirely different culture inside the company that has been evolving for a decade now. I don't know where it ends. I don't see it turning around, though. I continue to see nothing but trending in that direction of more collaboration, more openness.
So you've allowed us to hurl abuse at you for half an hour. So I have a request that you are free to say no to. You've allowed us to ask some open, frank, honest questions about Microsoft and open source. Do you think you'd be willing to let our community do the same thing, and we'll have them post some questions probably on the forum, and you can choose to respond to some? Does that sound like
an
interesting
happy
thing to do?
So to do.
Okay. Hooray. And then I will say, in doing a little bit of research for this segment, I knew that Microsoft was doing some cool new stuff. I was, to be frank, impressed with the breadth of the different kind of things that you're doing. So kudos to not only you, but to the organization. And it'll be, I think, interesting to watch over, let's say, the next 5 years to see really how different bits of the open source ecosystem react to the changing world that is Microsoft. I would like to end on a little bit of snark, just to get a little bit of snarking for Microsoft.
Of course.
Whoever's in charge of naming Windows, I didn't realize how hilariously bad it was. So let's throw out really old versions and start with Windows 3.1 as version 1, we'll say.
You want this?
We'll ignore Windows for work groups.
For posterity.
We'll get rid of Windows for work groups because that was a little more aimed at businesses. So even though it's not on the NT kernel line, we'll throw it out. So then you went to Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows 2000, and you're thinking, a pattern. 3 is a pattern. We're just going to name it after years. Every few years, we'll come out with Windows 2002 or 2003, whatever is. Nope, curveball. Windows ME, Windows XP, out of nowhere is Windows Vista. And then for the 8th version of Windows, Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1, thinking there's a pattern, Windows 10, totally skip 9. I don't understand the progression there. It's fascinating,
I know the Windows 9 answer. I don't know about all the rest. They're all stupid. Where the hell Vista came from? But I have heard a plausible reason why you don't call it Windows 9, which is there were too many people doing string comparisons on the version number. So Windows 9 would be less than Windows 95. So it would default to a really old version. And I've heard that. That's the sort of thing where if you read Raymond Chen's blog about all the mad backwards compatibility stuff they do, like Windows Explorer has got things like entire fake menus in memory because some program in 2001 used to grovel through the Explorer menu rather than doing it the real way.
Those kinds of engineering decisions are the things that when I talked about the RHEL build, you know, the engineering thing that Microsoft had to be good at by the time they got to Windows 2000 was, okay, so you have 10,000 ISVs and 10,000 IHVs. What's the cross product of that test grid look like? And why does it take 6 months to go from, you know, kind of code complete to RTM? That's a hell of an engineering problem to solve. And that is a hell of a barrier to entry. So it's, you know, pretend for a moment that they open sourced all of Windows back in that day. Well, first of all, you'd have to figure out how to build it. And that would presume that you could get over all of the third-party software that was wired into it that we had obligations to protect. And then you'd have to build a test farm that could do that kind of thing. It's like, I'm pretty sure that you would continue to buy Windows from the Windows company rather than Jeremy OS from some company in Canada. Branding is magic, and we've all seen too many examples of it done badly, and I wasn't here for so many of those examples, so I can't comment on it.
Is the new version going to be called Windows 11 to finish on? Make your prediction, Steve.
I am not predicting such things. I work in the Azure group. I have no idea what those folks in Windows are doing, but I'm sure it'll be good for customers.
And I think that's a wrap.
That was the show. Thank you very much, Mr. Wally, for coming on and being brutally berated.
much appreciated.
I didn't feel that at all. It was a pleasure to be here. Happy to help out.
No, it's fabulous. We very much appreciate you acting as our guest presenter and as our expert on both licenses and the internal the internal devices of Microsoft. That's fabulous. There is one amazing thing I wanted to mention. We didn't have time to actually talk about news that was going on, but this came up. It's not really news. It's just massively hilarious. Stripe have decided to drop Bitcoin support because Bitcoin is stupid. They actually say that it's not really Bitcoin is not really a store of value anymore. It's just a thing that people trade about. Transaction costs are really, really high, and it costs tens of dollars to do a transaction, which makes it about the same amount as bank wire. And if you buy something, by the time the transaction gets confirmed, it's changed that much that you've spent the wrong amount on it. And so they've dropped it.
Almost as if someone predicted this would happen this year.
It is. But
no, I think it's a little early for me to be.
What was the phrase that was going around yesterday? They want to call them. It's Bitcoin is a Dunning-Krugerrand.
Nice.
Well, that's the Stripe.
I did not invent that. That was a joyful discovery on Twitter the other day.
I did not see that. The Stripe thing almost reads a little sad the way they worded it. It's almost like, it's not you, it's me. It's, you're just more of an asset, and I need more of a medium of an exchange, and it's just worded very
odd. It's a Stripe Dear John letter.
Yeah, exactly, dear Stripe. Oh, but yeah, we didn't have time for the news. Although I did have another one, and this I don't want to talk about it as a news segment, but in researching the news, there was an article yesterday that over 90% of Gmail users still don't have two-factor authentication on. So please, right now, stop listening to the show, and not just for Gmail, anything important, your bank, any email, anything where you can reset passwords, please just enable two-factor authentication. 90% that's got to stop.
Yeah. It's not hard, right? I'm in the 10%. My parents are in the 10%. I'm not actually sure about my daughter. I should go and give her a beating about precisely that thing. But yeah, just go ahead and turn it on. Wally, you've got two-factor auth turn on. You've probably got nine-factor auth turn on and stuff.
No, just two-factor auth everywhere.
Yes, so go and turn on two-factor auth. That will be our good deed for January 2018. So thank you very much, Mr. Wally. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Oh, and I think before we record next, one thing that we haven't done recently is if we will be speaking at any conferences, and I will be at FOSDEM.
Oh, yes.
On February 3rd.
Yep.
So if you'll be near Brussels, come check it out. I'll be on Saturday, and I believe Mr. Wally will be there as well, so you can come say hi to him.
I will.
So. You should really go to that, actually, yep. Because that will be a brilliant talk, in my opinion.
I believe it will.
I know what it's about.
So thanks for listening, and see you in Brussels.